Hey there, my name's Jared Holt, and welcome to Posting Through It. This is a bi-weekly podcast released every other Monday, and it examines our cultural and political decay as it exists online. Each week, I talk to a guest whose work I really appreciate and whose perspectives I really value. We talk for about half an hour and unpack whatever latest badness is going on in the world and plaguing our condition. You can find the episode archive of Posting Through It on postingthroughit, all one word, .com. While you're there, consider subscribing for $5 a month to keep this thing going. There's also a newsletter there. Sign up for that. It goes out in between episodes. And before we get started and I bring in my guests here, a quick logistical note. This will be the last podcast episode until the new year. I'm going to take a couple weeks off along with the couple weeks I get at my day job for the holidays so I can relax and unwind. If you're a paid supporter of Posting Through It, your contributions will be paused and any time will roll over because I would feel terrible if you were giving me money while I'm not doing anything. With that out of the way, we'll keep it moving here and head straight into our interview. God's plan. I hold back sometimes, I won't. Yeah. I feel good sometimes, I don't. Yeah. I finesse down Western Road. Hey, yes. Might go down to GOD. Yeah, wait. I go hard on Southside G. Yeah, wait. I've been wanting to do an episode on Christian nationalism for a while now, but I've been derailed by news events of the past, well, you know, a long time. But today I finally got to record that episode, and I've got an amazing guest with me today who's going to help us understand why it seems that Christian nationalism is just keep coming up in conversation again, and what the movement looks like today, particularly as it expresses itself online. Dr. Anthea Butler is a professor of religious studies and Africana studies at the University of Pennsylvania, and she's been generous to share some of her time with me and all of you. How are you doing, Dr. Butler?
I'm great, Jared.
I've been seeing your name go around everywhere lately between all the media appearances. I believe you got a couple of awards recently, too.
Yeah.
So I'm really grateful that you've cut aside some time to talk to me and talk to my listeners and help us learn a thing or two about Christian nationalism today. Yeah. First, I just wanted to ask how you got started in this. Christian nationalism, I don't think is one of those things that, you know, the average 17, 18 year old is sitting around thinking, you know, I'm going to go to college, I'm going to go to school, and this is what I'm going to do. So how did you get started here?
Well, you know, it's kind of a conflation of things. I write about evangelicals and evangelicalism. So that was one piece of it. The second piece was I had written a book that wasn't out yet at 1/6 called White Evangelical Racism, The Politics of Morality in America. So I've been interested in religion and politics and intersection for a long time. But when 1/6 happened, it was pretty clear that this just wasn't like, oh, we want to stop the steal. It was, we want to stop the steal. Like God is helping us not to stop the steal, to stop the steal, right? And so it was this thing. And I actually said, you know, nationalism in the book. And so when the book came out, everybody went, we must know a lot about Christian nationalism. And I do, but not in the way that we would have called it Christian nationalism at this particular point. I would say that there's several iterations of Christian nationalism, you know, historically. And if your listeners, you know, just think back a few years, it used to be people would say, make America great again. That's kind of one way to phrase, you know, Christian nationalism. And there's another way to say it if you want to think about American exceptionalism. But all of those terms are predicated and based on not just the greatness of America, but a religious belief about America. That is that God appointed this to be a Christian nation, and that's why it's great. And so while we talk a lot about Christian nationalism, I think it's really important to talk about the variations of that, first of all, and then secondarily to try to understand why it's so a big deal right now and will continue to be a big deal.
Well, let's start there then. Christian nationalism, as you noted, is the term that is kind of being used now. But, I think anybody who's honest about history will tell you that Christianity specifically has been used to justify all kinds of policies and all kinds of actions throughout world history, let alone U.S. history. So take us back, you know, as far as the iteration of this in the United States, as to the degree we're talking about a movement, what did that look like?
Well, I think, you know, the country has struggled with this from the very beginning. If we think about what the founders and the framers wanted, I'm specifically thinking about, you know, Jefferson here and the ways in which the Constitution was set up and the Declaration of Independence. We have a few things that we can point to that show how they were very wary of religion. So, you know, obviously we fight the Revolutionary War to get rid of, you know, the British, right? And the British come with a religion. They're Anglican, right? And they want everybody to be that. Puritans and others come here so that they can have religious freedom. So religious freedom is very important to think about with America. But the founders didn't want to associate America with a particular kind of religious faith. And I think that's the important part that gets conflated right now. Most of the time, people don't like to think about that. But this was all about, let's not have a religious test for elected office. We don't want to care about that. We want to care if they do things right. People forget that Thomas Jefferson had a Quran, and which has been used to, you know, swear in members of Congress who are Muslim. Also, he famously wrote this letter to the Danbury Baptist Church, where he talks about there should be a wall of separation between church and state. When people ask me this now, separation of church and state, I say, oh.
No, of course not.
Here we don't have it. And that's a thing that I think is really important. So when we start from that particular point, you can see that, you know, the intentions of the founders and framers are about, let's have religious freedom. Everybody's free to worship the way that they want. What reality begins to happen is that you get preachers and others, and specifically Christians, who get imbued with the sense that there is something prophetic about America. There is something that is in the Bible, or if to use the term that General Flynn said, America is in the Bible. I'm like, where, dude?
And they're talking about the United States of America. Talking about the United States of America, because when Matthew mentioned it in the Bible, he wasn't talking about the physical ground that he was on. He was talking about something in the distance. So if we are going to have one nation under God, which we must, we have to have one religion, one
you know, I'm trying to think, is it that point where it says we fly on eagle's wings? Is that the Eagles football team, the Eagle, that's the, you know, United States thing?
That's Revelation too. Don't want that.
Yeah, I know. I was just like, are you kidding? But, you know, this was actually in that speech where he made, you know, back in, I believe it was 2021, where he said that America should be a Christian nation, basically. And so you get people who think about this kind of history. And the other part about this is, and I think this is really important to mention, you have people that read these kinds of histories from, you know, Christians like David Barton and others who write a particular kind of divine history about America. You know, one of the things I thought was really interesting when the first time I went to Israel was that I saw these magnets with the American flag and the Israeli flag, you know, hooked together, right? And so people tend to think about America and Israel as being locked into this kind of prophetic way of visioning things. And so I think a lot of this Christian nationalism, especially now, comes through that. But there's so many ways, you know, historically that we could point to through various points in time. You know, even how, if we talk about Kevin Cruz's book, In God We Trust, where he talks about how that phrase got added to the Pledge of Allegiance. Even that was a way of constructing this idea that America was a Christian nation, first of all, and secondarily was something that should be, Christianity should be associated with America very strongly.
And I'm sure it's a bit earlier, but at least in my mind, I kind of associate like the 80s and turn of the 90s, sort of that Reagan style of conservatism with the rise of the religious right as a political a very concerted political, intentional political voting bloc. First off, if I'm wrong, please correct me.
It's earlier than that, but I mean, I think that's a good space to think about it, because I think there's a way in which, you know, that is the, it's not just the rise, it's sort of the flourishing of the right, right? And how, you know, people like Jerry Falwell Sr. are able to articulate a certain kind of way to think about America through televangelism, through the moral majority, and all of those kinds of things. So, and then Reagan, when he, you know, refers to the speech by John Winthrop, when they come here, and, you know, this is the shining city on the hill. Nobody knows that Winthrop said it. They all think Ronald Reagan came up with that phrase, right? So America is the shining city on the hill. Yeah, okay. That gives you a sense in which you imbue this with a nationalistic idea. We are the example of the light to the nations, right? To use kind of a evangelical sort of terminology. But I think that's a good space to start. I think, you know, that subsequent presidents, you know, always kind of, you know, imbued this in certain kinds of ways, whether they're Democrats or Republicans. You know, you'll never not hear a president not say, God bless America, right?
Yeah.
Because that's just standard speech.
And every political candidate, at least for president, will tell you that they go to church, whether they do or not.
Yeah. Yeah. Whether they do or not, and whether they do it regularly or not, as in the case of Donald Trump. So, you know, same thing with Obama, actually. Obama didn't go to church that much. But then again, you know, is that a requisite for being president? Probably not. But everybody seems to think it is.
Yeah. So this sort of political body, organized political body, has kind of grown into what we see today. I used to work at Right Wing Watch, and I would go to like Values Voter Summit and
God help you,
Ralph Reed's thing.
Whatever God you believe in, if not.
Oh my gosh. And it was always just so off-putting to me. Like, I'm not a particularly religious person, right? So I was totally out of my zone. I was raised in the South, you know. For all my mom's attempts, I did not take in the church.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was always just bizarre to see on the main stage, you know, 1 hour, you've got someone like Lance Wall now coming up talking about Seven Mountains Dominionism. And then 30 minutes later, Ted Cruz or somebody's walking up on stage to sort of kiss the ring of, you know, Tony Perkins and appeal directly to these constituencies and these whole, you know, organizations that, while I think, you know, maybe they perceive some kind of stigma, at least some of them, on the word Christian nationalism, by all intents and purposes, you know, share the same rhetoric, have sort of that same vision as the United States is something that, you know, even if there's a religious test, is guided by their specific religious principles. And it's, as far as that flourishing goes, I was wondering if you would sort of embellish on that and sort of explain how it came to rise up. I imagine there may have been like a turning point at some point, right?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think that there's moments, or as I would say, what are the ebbs and the flows, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think about, you know, if we're talking 20th century, let's go there, because I think that's the easiest place to go. You know, one place that this is a flow is right after Second World War, when you have Billy Graham, and you're talking about, you know, communism as a big threat, right? So this is one moment that, you know, that you have to think about religion in America and to fight the scourge of communism. Because back then, what a lot of people don't realize is that people think about communism as a religion. It's an anti-God religion, but it's a religion to them, right? Mm. So that's one moment. You know, maybe the next moment doesn't come until the 80s and 90s, but I think a very important moment in terms of when we talk about the 21st century is 9/11. 9/11 becomes this, you know, kind of psychic moment for the country, this attack that happens, you know, at the World Trade Center and the Pentagon and Shanksville, that people have to sort of reflect. And then in that moment, Islam is the focus of the anti-religion thing. Now, what has happened in this third phase in which we had the attack on the Capitol, this third phase is a little different because it's an internal struggle, right? It's not something external to America. It's internal to America. In other words, it's America's fighting each other and thinking one group of people is more, you know, to use their terminology, unfortunately, demonic and, you know, not for America than these others. And I think that's the really important part about what's happening right now, is that unlike some of these other times where it's the external kind of force, it is the inward looking, internal kind of fighting between Americans who think that, you know, one group is worse than another or is trying to take down the country because of the way that things get told and lies that are said that make it very difficult to handle what's happening now with Christian nationalism in a different kind of way.
I think that's a really great point to bring up, because I if you look at the modern political discourse, at least on the political right, which Christian nationalism largely aligns with, the way that people like Marjorie Taylor Greene or Charlie Kirk, people who have kind of come forward and said, yes, I am a Christian nationalist and I'm not ashamed of it, which is a little bit terrifying in its own right. But, yeah. You know, it's the way they talk about people they perceive as their enemies is exactly as you said. It's not just Democrat policies are terrible and they'll make your life worse. It's demonic. It is, you know, LGBT people are trying to, you know, destroy your kids, sexualize your kids, which is like an evil thing to think about, right? And it's this sort of typecasting in larger narratives of good versus evil, red team versus blue team. And it's really alarming because if you go back in history, you look at how fascist regimes have historically come to power, it has to do with a lot of that. And I sometimes worry, you know, there's tons of like really great religion reporters out there. Religious News Service is great. New York Times has a couple people that are good. But I almost wonder if some of this just gets chalked up to the way, you know, the sort of centrist pundits like to talk about political polarization or whatever. Do you?
Yeah.
I imagine you would think it's a little bit more than that, but.
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think, there used to be religion pages all around the country in newspapers, right? People who cover religion. Now there's not so much, right? There are reporters who cover religion well, but they're not dedicated religion reporters per se, you know, except that maybe New York Times, Washington Post, Houston Chronicle has some people, right? You know, but it's few and far between. So that's one. I think the punditry and the politicals, you know, we'll put that in quotation marks, don't really understand that this religious hyperbole is very dangerous. You know, I want to give an example about how I think this has changed. In the 90s, and I don't use these groups for a specific reason, Stormfront was broken up in part because, you know, they came after the FBI, ATF, everybody came after them and realized that white identity movements were really terrible. But we had this moment in the 21st century where nobody would come after the same people who ran into the Capitol, like the Proud Boys and Oath Keepers, right? They were just one part of a bigger group. And so while everybody said, we couldn't believe that 1/6 happened, I was like, I could have told you 1/6 was going to happen because I saw it in December. And, you know, when they were, you know, marching around at the Jericho March in D.C., nobody wants to think religious people are going to take up arms. But religious people talk about violence all the time. And it's not, and we've been trained because of 9/11 to think that's just Muslims. And that's just not true. Christians are very violent. And they like guns. I mean, you know, if we're going to go back to the 19th century, we can talk about the Battle Hymn of the Republic. So, you know, this kind of martial imagery, the imagery of violence and fighting for God and fighting for justice, they have appropriated. And that has really changed what is, you know, what's happening right now. And it's really dangerous. Very dangerous.
Now, Dr. Butler, I wanted to ask how you've observed Christian nationalist movements approaching the internet. You're someone who has built an online persona. I hate that word, online persona. It's you, right? But it's
me. Yeah, it's
the
me.
Little avatar with your name next to it.
And
you've used that to spread knowledge about these kind of topics and other things that you study. But it's not just your voice in the room, right? There is, you know, like every other conservative movement of the 21st century, they've realized what an asset the internet is to advancing their messages and advancing their causes. As somebody who is also mixed up in that space and who has looked at that space, what's your read on it? How, you know, have there been any parts of online communication that Christian nationalist movements have really gravitated to? Or is it sort of like the rest of it where it's like kind of all over the place?
Well, you know, what's interesting about this is that a lot of what happened prior to 1/6 was on Twitter. And people could see it in there. I forgot the woman's name who was at Twitter who tried to warn them and say, hello, they're planning some stuff. And nobody wanted to pay attention. And then the next day, you know, it's proliferating. One of the more interesting things that happened on 1/6 was a site called Bellingcat. Mm-hmm. And they pulled all the video, all this stuff. And people have been searching through that to kind of identify the people who were at 1/6. And that's still going on. I think that's really important. But there were platforms like Telegram. Yeah, Parler, all of these places were being used. But you might tend to think about them as outliers, right? Because people didn't, you know, some people who are just regular folks never ventured into those kind of sites. Mm-hmm. But the reality is that they were very much amplified. And so, you know, one of the things that I knew from just being on Twitter for a long time was that you had these blogs that would start a rumor, right?
Yep.
So whether that was Weasel Zippers or something else, and then it would get up the food chain, you know, Breitbart might pick it up, all these other groups will pick it up. And then it ended up being on Fox, right? And so you could take that information and move it up the food chain, the media food chain, so to speak, of the right wing. And then it would, you know, get out to the people it needed to, so that even, you know, your grandpa and grandma who are sitting at home, 80 something years old, are going to hear the same thing that the guy heard on Telegram or Twitter, right?
Yeah.
And maybe a week or two ago. And so I felt like that was the reason why Stop the Steal worked so well, except when they tried to pick a place that was supposed to be Four Seasons and picked a landscaping instead, they don't even know how to read the web. But it's this interesting moment in which all of these ecosystems of media help to amplify a message. It's also helped to amplify, and this is the biggest thing, conspiracy theories. And so with Q and everything else, it's been hard to catch up to that, because when you have all of this stuff moving back and forth across spaces and across social media spaces, it's really easy to radicalize people. The algorithm will bring it to you. You don't have to go anywhere. You click on one thing, you're going to get 10 more things.
I feel like during the Bush years and even through the Obama years, that like Christian nationalism, what we would call Christian nationalism now, was like constantly ridiculed and satired and criticized. I, you know, grew up watching the Colbert Report and the Daily Show every night. And I would just remember them just ripping these guys apart, these televangelists mm-hmm. and things like that. And I think today, there's certainly, like, I do a lot of work on conspiracy theories and extremism and stuff, but I do think there's kind of a disconnect, and I don't want to erase anybody here, but like there's broadly a disconnect, if we're going to talk about the media that reaches Meemaw mm-hmm. and Peepaw, like you were saying, of connecting sort of these modern predicaments, this modern radicalization and internet activity to Christian nationalism as sort of a broader vision. And I almost wonder if, I guess I'm asking, do you have any theories about why that might be? Because it's not that Christian nationalists, you know, lost the battle for same-sex marriage and hung up their hats and just walked away. They were super active during the Trump administration, you know, going in, praying around the president and the Oval Office and whatnot, you know, I guess I'm curious if you have any theories as to why maybe attention seemed to shift off of this for a moment in the broader public discourse.
I think the attention shifted because they thought that they were over, you know? Well, there was two ways the attention shifted. So let me be more specific. One way the attention shifted is when Trump got in office, the only question that the media could ask is, why are all those Christian people voting for Donald Trump? He said, grab him by the, you know what? He did all these things. He had three wives. This can't be what it is, except that they got snookered. And what I mean by that is that they believed everything that evangelicals were telling them about themselves, right? You know, yes, we're moral people. Yes, this and that. I'm like going, oh, they want power just like everybody else.
Yeah.
You just believe it, right? So you decided to believe the nice, homely version of the self-construction that they made for you to see. So that's one. I think the other thing is that what they were doing changed. What evangelicals were doing were changed. In other words, Make America Great Again appealed to all of those people, because it appealed to a message that has always been true. If you are a believer in Christian nationalism or anything else, you also have to believe that something is in fear of decline. And so, in other words, if you think that America is going down the tubes because of immigration or because of other things, right? You know, CRT, whatever it is that the thing that's messing up the day, then you have to realize that those kind of things are taking away from America. And you need to fix America, right? So then it becomes, how do we fix this, right? Well, we got to make America great again, and we need to just believe that this is a Christian nation and that the lack of Christianity is making everything terrible. One other piece. The other piece that I think that people just slept on was that, let's use abortion as a good example. You know, yeah, they didn't get same-sex marriage. They didn't stop same-sex marriage. But, you know, what happened with Dobbs? people forgot that this was like the long project.
Yeah, generational project.
Yeah, a generational project. And I think that, you know, I think that liberals and moderates just slept on this and thought, we don't have to do anything about this here. And you could start to see in 2012 where, you know, Wendy Davis stood and filibustered in the Texas legislature all night long in her tennis shoes. And these restrictions of abortion rules and laws started chipping away at all this. And then you get five Catholics on the court and then boom, you know, the end.
Yep.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was a process in which I think, you know, moderates and liberals were not looking at. And those who were very much invested in this have always been invested in the long game and not the short game.
Right. So I think something that is also kind of underappreciated with Christian nationalism, and I'm looking forward to hearing your thoughts because you wrote a book on this, but there's a subtext to Christian nationalism, and sometimes that is more obvious in its targeting of communities like immigrant communities, where, mm-hmm. you know, individual churches may be nice to, you know, immigrants or undocumented immigrants in their communities that are struggling. But broadly speaking, this evangelical political coalition has different ideas policy-wise. But this idea of returning the United States to this, you know, foreseen or aspirational Christian model often leaves a lot of people out. It is often unspoken, but I would argue very strongly implied that this vision of a Christian America is also a vision of a white Christian America.
Yeah.
And since you wrote the book on it, you know, I'm curious what you think about that. If you think that, you know, over the years that has waned at all, or if it is, I mean, maybe worse today even.
It's probably worse. I mean, this is why you got somebody like Nick Fuentes can say all these sort of white supremacist things and be like, well, how am I saying this, right? It's the, you know, I said it in the book, and I think a friend of mine, Jeff Charlotte, picked up on it and actually expounded on it a lot better than I did, you know, because I took it as a sort of side thought, but he's right. It's what I said called the proximity to whiteness. So in other words, if you're an immigrant or somebody, you know, what goes along with Christian nationalism is a supposition that, you know, if you hold these same beliefs as white Christians do in America, you're going to make it too. And that's compelling for people. It is a way to sort of frame yourself. So it's why when we're thinking about voting, you know, maybe, you know, Latino immigrants and others are thinking, maybe I'm going to be more on the right than I would be on the left, right? Or people don't understand, you know, how come Marco Rubio keeps winning? I'm like, because, you know, he's got the Cuban population who ran away from communism, who are the, you know, inheritors of this 1950 thing put into 21st century, right? So I think it's really interesting to sort of think about how whiteness acts as a tool, not just for white people, but for everybody to aspire to this, you know, ideal of it, whatever that ideal is. But, you know, unfortunately, most white people don't want to be that thing either. It's kind of weird to think about it that way, but it's true. And so it's a construction, you know, and it's not a reality. It's something that people imagine that America is and imagine that Christianity does. And I think the other part of it is, especially for people who are non-white and non-American, but aspire to be American, it's the idea that if I just show enough loyalty to this country, that's going to bring me in. If I just show enough patriotism. And I think that's a really important, you know, driver of all of this as well.
So with that subtext, I wanted to ask what your experience has been like as a scholar on these topics, because in the field of academia, it's hard enough being a woman. It's certainly hard enough being a person of color. You happen to be both, and you're studying a political space that is, you know, predominantly run and designed for white men. While doing some research for the show, I happened to come across your Turning Point USA professor watch list page.
I'm sure I saw lots of lovely things on there.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. If you aren't familiar, it's basically the naughty list that Turning Point USA makes of all the professors teaching things that they really wish they wouldn't, you know?
Yes.
So what's that experience been like? Has it been hard to be, I mean, have you felt shut out of any conversations, or have, you know?
Like this. If I've been shut out of conversations, I seem to be talking more about this than ever. But what was different about it, I would say from 2010 to 2016, I got a lot of flack. And that was before we even got to Trump. And what happened with when Trump was elected, I was just like, you know what? I'll lock my account for about 8 or 9 months and talk to people. And then I kind of came back out and started writing. But what I'm finding now is that anytime I say white man in a sentence, like some dudes are writing me like, you know anything and blah, blah, blah. You're just, you know, you're a racist because you're racist because you talk about racism. You know how it goes, right?
Yeah.
And I just kind of laugh about that stuff. Yeah, I was on the inaugural Turning Point list. I'm sure I'm one of those liberal professors. But I laugh because I tell, you know, my thing is like, I know you all and I know you better than you know yourselves. And the other part of this is that you can never say that I don't understand you, because I do understand you. It's just that you don't like the fact that I can talk about you in this way. And so, you know, that has caused a lot of stuff. I had death threats, you know. I don't have a published office on campus where you can see it, you know, and all of that stuff. And I am mindful that we're in a phase right now that I think is going to increase, unfortunately, whether that's about me or other people, that, you know, people will be targeted. People will be looked at, you know, especially professionals and teachers and things like this. We're already seeing it in places like Oklahoma and others. So I think we live in dangerous times. I think we live in times where we have to confront all of this. And I'm really not sure that, you know, the feds or the Justice Department really grasp how bad this is right now. It seems like to me they're just trying to, they're like the little Dutch boy trying to stick a finger in the dike and there's another space breaking.
That's a good way to put it. Well, I'm really glad that you are doing this work, that you have, you know, published these works and that you're sharing your perspectives like this. I think it's invaluable to have that kind of enriched historical perspective in the discourse, especially these days. Dr. Yeah. Butler, thank you so much for spending some time on the show with me today. Every guest here gets the same last question. What's your favorite thing on the internet right now?
Oh, my favorite thing on the internet right now. This is a hard question because honestly, my favorite thing on the internet right now is reading trash about Meghan and Harry, because it's actually, you know, it sounds very unerudite, but in a way it's not, because I'm really interested in how the press works in the UK. And so there's some similar things here. And so for me, it's not just been this sort of, I'm reading these gossip rags, but I'm watching how they construct, you know, the arguments and everything. And they've just been ridiculous since this Netflix series came out. I know this will date the podcast, but that's been interesting. But honestly, my favorite thing is looking at anything about the Philadelphia Eagles because we're winning.
Dr. Butler, thanks so much. I'll put a link to your latest book down in the description, social media, website, all that good stuff. I really appreciate you coming on today.
Thanks so much, Jared. Take care. Don't catch you slipping up. Look what I'm whipping up. This is America. Don't catch you slipping up.